antenna that burned out the battery or changed the whatever. Because if you remember, I told you, told Andy, last time I had been on here, everything was fine, and we didn't see them. We had a lot of light. Then I went on the radio. That's when everything happened.
And as you know, that could be a coincidence, and maybe it's related. And for a lightning strike to damage a balance, where we're fairly sure by the research that Roy has done that a damaged balance is because of overheating, would the lightning strikes have enough time to create the heating of that balance? It's an interesting question that we don't know. Lightning strikes usually are, you know, 20 microseconds long. They've got a lot of energy, but would it heat up a massive device like the core of that balance? Don't know. So, that's about as much as, if we have anybody with any further questions or comments, previous experience with lightning they want to tell us about, give me a call with us right now. K2RIW and the Tech Man.
Into my problem.
Go right ahead. And you living right on the seashore, guarantee you've seen lots of lightning in Far Rockaway. And maybe a few times it's even struck your windjammer tower. I keep forgetting the brand name. How about you, Bessie?
It sure has. I wanted to agree with you. I have been brutally struck by lightning twice. I lost appliances, I lost radios, all kinds of things. But I know in both cases it came in through the power lines. It did not come in through the antenna. And I've seen sparks on my antenna. Did not damage my equipment. But both times we got struck by lightning here to the point where I had to replace all the radios and appliances in the house and everything else, it struck the power lines, most definitely, and 2MB.
Yeah, thank you, Barry. And that makes a lot of sense. Because as I said, if you're in a helicopter and you're looking down on your neighborhood, there's a tremendous amount of wire, power line wiring going between every one of those utility poles, every 150 feet, up and down all of those streets. That's a huge target, a great big mat of wire. Every street has got wire. So lightning's going to strike that 90-some-odd% of the time. On top of that, your tower is the local lightning arrestor. The tallest mast coming out of your top of your tower, I guarantee it's got a whole lot of arcing from time to time. You and I have seen arcing from things on our towers when we're up there during certain kinds of weather conditions. And that's quite often doing a local discharge, a slow local discharge. Just like a real lightning arrestor on top of a house is sort of an upside down metal broom with a whole bunch of spikes on it. And there are some commercial towers that have things like that through a slowly discharge in a controlled manner. I'm now going to go over to the next person who signed in was Joe, KC2, Queen Yankee Whiskey. Go right ahead, Joe. Get your IW in the TechNet. Kilo Charlie 2, Queen Yankee Whiskey, mobile. K2RIW, still there, Joe? Looks like we kept him too long. He probably reached touchdown. Okay, that was the question and answer period. We're now going to go over to the science talk section, run by Dr. Roy, AC2GS. By the way, Roy also has a technical net twice per month on the other repeater he uses, the Kings County Radio Club. And I think that one's on Thursday night, as I remember. Or maybe it's Tuesday. I only checked into it once, and I've forgotten what day it was there. AC2GS, K2RIW. You got it right.
Thank you very much, Dick. It's the second and fourth Wednesday of each month on KC2RC. That's the 146.730. Starts at 9 and goes on until people are tired of listening to me. Anyway, let me just remind people that if you have any questions or topics or comments or differences of opinion or what have you, the address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And for things that I talk about, I have links that are available on a website. Type in on your browser, roy.ac2gs.com, and it will bring up the web link. Don't type in Dr. Dave that Richie thinks I am. Type in roy.ac2gs.com. Let me drop. Okay, I want to start with a couple of little stories and little comments. Recently, I don't know if you get a lot of phone scams, but I get phone scams, and people leave messages of all kinds of strange things. And recently, I had a guy, well, I didn't have a guy, it was a synthetic voice, that came on and it said it was Microsoft's company, and my Windows had expired, and the Microsoft company was going to lock me out of my computer unless I called them back and gave them apparently a credit card number and paid up for the next unit of time for Windows. Obviously, that's a scam because Microsoft doesn't lease the operating system. Windows 10, they actually gave the operating system away for free. Now, sometimes you have to pay for it, sometimes not. If you talk nice to the person on the phone, occasionally I've heard that they give you a freebie access code for it. So that's that little phone scam. There's another one where they call up in their Apple company, and for them, they say your iCloud has been compromised, and if you pay us money, we'll clean it up for you. That doesn't happen in real life. And then there's other guys who kind of do flips on that, and they do Microsoft again, but then they say that you have a pirate in your computer. It's been taken over, but they were able to sense it, and for a nominal fee, they will get rid of the enemy hiding within your computer. So if anyone calls you and wants your credit card number, probably the best thing to do is hang up for them. Let me drop for a sec. An awful scam, by the way, that they do over the phone is they call up and they say they're the Internal Revenue Service. And you're in arrears, and the Fed is going to come and get you in a couple of days unless you give us your credit card number and you pay off what you owe us. Obviously, that's a scam as well. So be very, very careful with who you talk to on telephone. Let me break, and I'll move on to the next story. Okay, here's a couple of little fun facts. Just to give you an idea of what science is doing while we're talking here. They're figuring out more and more esoteric, clever ways of testing things, smaller and smaller samples, shorter and shorter time intervals. And there was an article that I read where they actually measured the viscosity of a human cell's nucleus. Now, a human cell is a very, very small thing. Nucleus is about 8% to 10% in volume of the total cell. It comes out to be a big 3 cubic micrometers in volume, and they were able to detect that the viscosity in that little teeny portion of each of our cells is approximately 300 times the viscosity of honey, which to me is interesting. When the cytoplasm, the fluid outside of the nucleus, is only about 3 or 4 times the viscosity of regular drinking water. Another thing they were able to measure, we've all talked about Albert Einstein and the photoelectric effect. He got a Nobel Prize for it. Let me drop for a sec. Scientists ask questions, and one of the things they were wondering is exactly how long it takes from the time, say, a photon hits an atom to the time that the electron gets ejected out. Well, up until recently, they couldn't really do that because the technology didn't allow it. The closest that they could measure as a time interval was something in the range of what's called a 100 attosecond, A-T-T-A second, which is one attosecond is a billion billionth of a second. So at 100, they couldn't measure it, but they fine-tuned the system, And now they can measure one single attisecond, and they figured out that it takes 40 attiseconds for the photoelectric effect to actually happen. Nothing happens instantaneously. That goes against the laws of physics. So, you know, it's one of the ways that's nice to know that science is improving their measurement, their accuracy, their precision, and giving us more and more information every day on things like that. Let me drop for any comments or questions. Yes, Wesley.
To the left. You were talking about nucleus. So we are able to see using electron microscope a row of atoms. And we can actually mechanically flip atoms that we want. And they're in the vicinity of nanometers range. And you talk about nucleus. So I'm kind of puzzled what you meant.
Not talking about the nucleus of an atom. I'm talking about the nucleus of a cell.
Got it. Thank you.
One of the things that's kind of nice to know is that the speed of light is very close to 1 nanosecond per foot. Nanosecond is 10 to the minus 9 seconds. A billionth of a second is a nanosecond. So in a billionth of a second, at the speed of light, that wave moves roughly 1 foot. And the next thing smaller than a nanosecond is a picosecond, 10 to the minus 12, which is something like a tenth of an inch. So when you start getting to these super fast numbers beyond a picosecond, attosecond, I think it's 10 to the minus 18, at the speed of light, we're talking about the signal going as far as the diameter of a proton. I haven't done that calculation, but we're talking about something in that vicinity. And there are people talking about the Big Bang. How long was the actual event? And they come up with fantastically fast numbers. Well, I can't believe it, that you simultaneously have zero dimension, an infinite amount of material, and a zero amount of time. It's just a combination you can't get. So when you start looking at speed of light as a limitation, certain sizes of getting smaller become a little bit ridiculous, I think. AC2GS, K2RIW.
Well, you know me. I love these discussions, and I love to have them with you. The problem, as I see it, is that the speed of light is a limitation in space. Before you have space, and it's during the Big Bang, everything was crunched to a really small amount of space, everything going away from that little piece of space can go at any speed that it wants, and that's why at the edges of the universe it appears to be going faster than the speed of light, because it's expanding, it's the scale factor, or it's expanding space itself, which has no limitation. Causality is events happening in space-time. Those, while it's in space-time, are limited by space-time to that rate. Once you take things out of space-time, which is really a pain in the backside to think about because it's really confusing, it's no longer limited by that. So the speed of light is an inherent limitation while you're in space. But whatever you want to conceive of what's not in space can go at any rate.
This spatial expansion that has been used quite often, how do you know when it's happening and when it's not happening? Can you control whether or not you're expanding through space or expanding space itself? And because of the Big Bang occurred something like 13.8 billion years ago, and that distance, 13.8 billion light years, is out at the perimeter of what we can observe. Is that the only place where space is expanding these days? Or can you get local space expanding in the middle of your nucleus, if you know what I mean? Wouldn't it be nice to be able to control whether or not we're expanding through space or expanding space itself? Turn the right knob and you expand space. And now you're no longer limited by what speed of expansion you can get. Sounds a little too convenient, Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW.
Well, I've heard you many times use the old peasant bread story, and it's a very nice metaphor for what's going on. If everything scaled up, then we wouldn't notice any difference, and so we wouldn't see faster than the speed of light speeds of the edges of the universe flying away from us. And the theory tends to be that gravity holds us together locally from any kind of expansion of space. The space is expanding around us and all over the place. There's no place that space isn't slowly expanding, but because there's a gravitational force kind of forcing us to stay together, it doesn't seem obvious to us. In our galaxy and our galactic clusters, gravity is strong enough to hold us all together. But all the other galactic clusters out there are flying away. And it's nothing special. We're not at the center. We're just one of everything that's just flying away at each other. Or at least that's the theory, they tell me.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Good evening, Roy. You made a statement before about the cells and the atoms. You know, I heard what you said, but I'm just curious. How many atoms do you think would be in a cell? You know, I'm assuming you could see a cell, one cell, with some kind of a microscope. You would need the electron microscope maybe to see an atom. But, you know, a ballpark figure, what do you think would be in one cell? How many atoms?
Probably a billion. Because, you know, atoms really are very, very light. If you want to think about things like, say, hydrogen, 2 grams of hydrogen are approximately made up of 6 × 10^23 of atoms. Now, that's a lot of atoms.
What's easier to say is one atom is from 0.1 to half of the nanometer interaction.
Okay, very good, Roy. It makes me think of the DNA. They say if you stretch it out, it's 3 feet long. I still don't get that, you know. But that's what they said.
WA2VDH with a question. VDH.
Bro, I was wondering if you could clarify something for me about the Big Bang. Isn't it an expansion of infinite density of matter into a void, or is it the actual expansion of the void itself? A little bit confused about that. I wonder if you could comment on that, Ben.
It's very difficult to explain because it doesn't really work in the theories that are available, and the English language isn't the greatest to translate it to. The theory breaks down at the moment of the Big Bang because, as you mentioned, it's an infinite density of mass. So scientists have a great deal of problems with dealing with infinities. Infinities are very problematic. So what the Big Bang is supposed to be is a quantum fluctuation in whatever that produces a great deal of its own mass energy coming into existence in this dimension. Now, there are guys with parallel universe theories, there are guys with stacked universes, bubble universes, all kinds of theories of exactly how you start with nothing and you get something. But one of the things that I hate is people, physicists, who tell you that the total energy in this universe is actually zero by an accounting trick of counting gravitational energy as negative and so all the rest is positive. So the total energy in this universe by that accounting is zero. So there's a lot of theories. There's no proof, as Dick repeatedly tells me, and I agree. But there are some very fascinating theories out there of what the heck this might have been caused by.
I guess I always thought that the void was already there, and it was just this very high density point of matter that
expands to fill it, but you're saying that it's more than that. It's the actual void itself, the actual space itself expanding along with the matter that started in the center.
Yeah, you tend to have a problem, again, with the semantics of what you mean by the void. If you mean by the void the vacuum of space, unfortunately, the vacuum of space is full of a lot of things. It's full of stray little particles, virtual particles that come in and out of existence. It has the space and timelines that can be warped that give us the sense of gravity that we feel all the time. And so space-time itself really should be thought of as a thing. And it's that thing that's expanded. Now, what is expanding, quote, in, end quote, is problematic, because how do you describe something that basically, fundamentally, doesn't really exist because there's nothing in it to exist in? So that's where English really falls apart on this conversation, but that's the best that I could do in English.
GXM.
Yeah, GXM.
82GS in the group, WB2GXM. Well, if you listen to the quote-unquote experts on the Discovery Channel, and I love to watch these shows, they will basically, they come out and tell you that the Big Bang created space and time, or space-time. Created it. Not expanded it from where it was before. Created it. WB2GXM.
And that is one of many theories. But there are a lot of other theories, and unfortunately, sometimes one show can't really do more than one or two theories well. It confuses a lot of people. There is one theory where there's nothing, and then Big Bang, and then there's something. That's rather simple, and it would be nice if things were simple. But there's a lot of other people who think that our own universe has created, either in black holes or other astronomical events, shadow universes that have kind of been birthed off like budding yeast. So there's that theory. There's also a stack theory. There's the multiverse theory. There's a hyperdimensional theory. It can get weirder and weirder, and depending upon the people producing these science shows, they either like it weird or they like it simple, and unfortunately, simple is probably not really going to end up being the truth. It's probably going to be much weirder than that.
What existed before the Big Bang? This is KB2MAR.
That's a very good question. And again, some people will tell you nothing happened before. It began at the Big Bang. But there are other guys out there who have Nobel Prizes in their living room who would suggest to you that time in the nature of universes is not continuous. So it's kind of like you can't get here from there type of thing. So there are other time intervals that aren't connected to ours through time that we can get to. So again, that kind of comes close to parallel universes and multiverses and other such things. Okay, everyone's speechless. While they're speechless, I'll go back to Paul. DNA is a helical structure, a spiral within a spiral within a spiral. If you take a look at an incandescent light bulb, you get a small sense of what might be going on, but you have to put a couple more coils through it. So DNA is very, very thin. It's about, I lost count, but probably something like 8 or 9 atoms across. But it's a continuous molecule, so if you tweeze it out, it's theoretically possible to stretch it a ridiculous amount, like 3 feet. In the other dimension, in thickness, it's non-measurable. It's down to nanometers. But in length alone, because it's a strand of double helixes, it can go to 3 feet, which is kind of amazing. And that's probably one of the big reasons why the viscosity of a cell nucleus is so dense, because it has this very, 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 very large molecule in a little bit of fluid, and that gives you a great viscosity.
Okay, that sounds good until you realize that you can't see the DNA atoms. You know, I think there's what, four different possible different types of atoms that are attached to it, different sequences. And that is changing the sequences and changing this and changing that. They measure this. They're looking at it. I don't know how they're looking at it if they can't see these atoms. They looked at it on the space station. You know, the astronauts looking at that. They're sequencing the DNA. Well, you know, what are they looking at? I mean, how do they even know they're doing it if they can't see it? That's an amazing topic, I think. Back to you.
Yes, it is, Paul. DNA is the abbreviation for deoxyribonucleic acid. It's not four different atoms. It's four different base groups, they call them. Adenosine, guanine, cytosine, thymine. They pair up. Adenosine pairs adenosine pairs with thymine, and cytosine pairs with guanine, and that's what keeps the plan straight when you're making copies of these things. But each base pair is something like about six atoms wide. So it like I said, it comes out to be something like 12 or somewhat. The way that we do it is we don't kind of look in with an electron microscope to see what that is, because you can't really do that for very long. You could hone in on a couple of atoms, but then you can't get to the next base pair without a lot of work. So what they do is enzymes and clever little tricks that bond to the different base pairs and then indicate what base pair they're sticking to, so you record it. And recently, about 10 years ago, they had a big project where they mapped the entire genome, where they chopped up a DNA and they put it through these machines, and they actually came up with a genetic code of one guy that they tested this on. So it is fascinating. They have to be clever about it, because you just can't look under an electron microscope and say, guanine, tyrosine. But it's fascinating. I agree with you.
Okay, very good. Yeah, the genome project. I think that was back in the Clinton era. They must be way beyond that now. Okay, very good. I'll let you continue on. I just wanted to know how they were doing this DNA thing and how many molecules and how many atoms are inside the cells. You're saying probably billions. Interesting. Back to you, Roy. I'll be listening.
I guess I'm going to add to the server.
Sure.
There's a science show going around that was on this week on National Public Radio, which says that RNA is almost more important than DNA. The DNA consists of pairs that make up the rungs of the ladder of the DNA helix. The RNA doesn't come in, you don't read the RNA code in pairs, you read them in triplets. There is a translation somewhere going on in this whole mechanism where the RNA code, three of those letters at a time, give you the recipe for all of the substances that are required. And I think we're talking about the amino acids and proteins and whatever. But the real work is done by the RNA, which as I see it is a subset of the DNA. And the RNA, this science show tried to say that the RNA is really more important, even though a lot of people haven't yet recognized that. Over to you, Roy, KQRIW.
Okay, I mean, that's an interesting way of looking at it, but ultimately you need both. The DNA is primarily a storage method. It stores the blueprints of how to build everything. It also has activators and inhibitors that cause those blueprints to be turned into something or not turned into something. You need RNA in order to build the things, because what happens is the DNA will unfurl and split apart, and it'll expose the base pairs. Then RNA will bind to one of the DNA strands in the composite manner, the same way that I said the DNA does with itself in the double helix, but it'll have a single strand of RNA, It's called messenger RNA. It then goes to an organelle called the ribosome, where every three base pairs is code for a certain amino acid. And so there's a mechanism where it says, okay, you said you have tyramine. That's coding for this amino acid. We'll plug it in here. Now let's go for the next three bases. Now we plug in another amino acid, and they build amino acids. And from amino acids, you get proteins and all kinds of fun stuff, catalysts, enzymes, all kinds of fun stuff. So it's the mechanism, you know, the DNA is the stored knowledge of the cell. The RNA is the hard worker building the damn thing.
So maybe the RNA is the program that allows you to build the real substances. The DNA is the executive program that tells you which snippets of RNA you use in what order and where. Is the DNA maybe the executive program and RNA is the real worker program? That's trying to put it into software vocabulary. Oh, you're right.
Well, you know, like anything in physics, life is very complicated. And so there's a lot of feedback mechanisms, and RNA changes DNA, DNA changes RNA, all kinds of fun stuff. But the way that I tend to think of it is all the instructions for how everything is built in us is in our DNA. None of it's built into our RNA. RNA is like Play-Doh. You take it apart, you put it back together. It's a means to convey information, if you will. So it conveys the information from the DNA to the ribosome and builds the proteins accordingly. And when its job is done, it disassembles itself and prepares to do this for another protein.
This is AC2IS. I can comment on some of this if you would like.
Bill. Bill, please.
Okay, so yeah, this is AC2IS here, and there's more than one kind or purpose, I guess, of RNA. The stuff that you've been talking about is referred to as mRNA or messenger RNA, and that typically contains the instructions to produce a single protein. And the ribosomes that you're talking about, another name for a structure formed by the ribosomes, I forget what that is. Basically, just as you described, they read the RNA and they will produce these proteins. The framing of three amino acids in the translation table to proteins is sometimes referred to as the quote-unquote central dogma of microbiology. And that table, there are actually exceptions to, and I think it's not very well understood when those exceptions happen or how the ribosomes understand what those exceptions are when they should take place. So everything is sort of, you know, we understand a lot, but everything is sort of more complicated than we currently understand it to be. Another type of RNA that exists is RNAi for RNA interference, and that will often serve to sort of suppress other functions. Let me break for a moment. So yes, the DNA, as far as I understand it, contains all the code that goes into making messenger RNA, but there's also a lot of interesting things. A lot of times the DNA that codes for a single piece of messenger RNA is not contiguous in the genome, so there's a process called gene splicing, and that serves to separate, I think they call them extrons from introns, so that one of them, you know, sort of falls out, and the rest is essentially the inverse of the message that gets coded onto the RNA, if that makes sense. The amino acids that go into RNA are not exactly identical. They differ slightly to what's in DNA. And there's so many things here, again, that are known and unknown. There's alternative splicing methods, so that sometimes two different pieces of messenger RNA are similar and have a lot of similarity between them can be produced by the same piece of DNA, and the splicing process is just different, and I don't think it's very well understood what controls this splicing process, and how much is RNAi involved in choosing which splicing method, or is it involved at all? I could go on, but let me know if any of this interests anyone.
Well, Bill, it certainly interests me. Base pairs aren't really amino acids, though, and it is true, as you said, that RNA doesn't use thyramine, it uses uracil, but it's the same basic principle. And just to complicate things even more, not to mention methylation, which is a control method of that triggers replication and translation of DNA sequences into proteins. But there are life forms that have evolved to use RNA as its nuclear material. So it has no DNA. It is a purely RNA-based life form. So life is really complicated, and the more layers of the onion you peel away, the more you find.
Which?
Continue commenting here?
Yes, Bill, feel free, and Lou, recognize, we'll get to you soon.
Hey, this is AC2IS, so you referred to methylation, and that introduces a whole new field called epigenetics, right? Another thing that I think is not very well understood, by the cutting edge of science, something that people are still very much working on, but that people thought that DNA was static, right? Which it is for the most part. The code that we can read out, those are the machines that read those are referred to as gene sequencers. And I can go into some detail on how those machines operate if you would like. But those machines do not read the state of whether or not a certain portion of the genome is methylated, and that people refer to as sort of keeping a state that can be changed, is not static. So two different people, say twins with the same DNA, or even the same person from one cell to another, the methylization or the methylation state, or the very many methylation states throughout the genome, can be very different from one cell to the next, and that could have something to do with sort of the personality of that cell, whether that's a skin cell or a liver cell or whatever else. All these things are still very much containing a lot of unknowns and are subject of very active research. AC2IS.
I agree with you entirely, Bill. There's a lot more research to be done. I don't think anyone in their wildest imaginations they have any of this sussed out, if you will. But, I'll just add another unfortunate complication. Even without the methylation, they found that, nowadays they're cloning dogs and cats and such because you can make money doing that, apparently. And they don't look the same. And they don't look the same because one of the many variations is not based on DNA, but on which gene a cell line decides to turn off during one period of growth. And depending upon which of the two copies it shuts off, it changes some characteristics of it. And there are other little things that just complicate life. Not all the DNA in a cell is in the nucleus. Some of it is stuck in places like the mitochondria. If you were to wipe out the mitochondrial DNA, you wouldn't be able to perpetuate those little organelles that give us our energy, and we would all die. So, again, there's layer upon layer upon layer. It's loads of fun to read about. Probably you could fill about a small library with what we know and a much bigger one with what we don't know.
I think you wanted to get to somebody else.
Flu wanted to make a comment, I believe.
Yeah, good evening. Bill, I think as he took the wind out of my sails, I was going to talk about the epigenetics with the methylation. One interesting thing, I guess, is that this is a mechanism where environmental influences can take hold. I understand methylation, you can have transgeneration effects, so that if one generation, let's say, experienced a famine, the progeny would be affected via this mechanism. So it's all very interesting, but I guess epigenetics, turning switches on and off, even though you have all this code of instruction in the DNA, you're now selectively choosing which ones to activate and which ones to ignore based on environment. And of course, the mitochondrial just took a CoQ10 to keep that thing pumping. Is that, they call it, I guess, the maternal DNA. And they trace, the female line that way. That's all. We're back to that.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Lou. I think Lysenko would have loved all this new information. He was kind of wrong with the basic premise, but in some cases it really follows along Lysenko's strange little theory. Mitochondrial DNA is considered maternal because the human sperm doesn't contain any mitochondria. So all of the mitochondria that you have in your body are descendants of your mother's egg cell mitochondria. So that's why it's a maternally transmitted genetic material. Okay, anyone else have any points, questions, or answers on this subject, or else I'll move on to the next little bit? Okay, now completely different. I recently came across a fairly unique patent, and I would like to link it on the website so that you can kind of take a look at it. Some people get this idea, although it's very nice to have a patent, and Dick has many patents under his name. Some patents are better than other patents, and just because something was approved for a patent doesn't necessarily mean that anyone tested it, because the patent office doesn't test your theories. If your theories don't violate some rule and they don't copy something else, they tend to give you a patent. So in that vein, I have a link on my website for one of the more amusing patents that I've come across, and this particular one goes back to 1989. It's a design for, I believe, a digital watch for dogs and cats and other animals based upon their lifespan. So in other words, you know, you've heard the story about 7 years, that one in human life is 7 years in a dog's life. So this would be a wristwatch that a dog would wear that would apparently go at 7 times the speed of the clocks that we own. So check it out. It's worth a giggle. Let me drop the comments. Okay, I've been talking about the Japanese probe Hayabusa 2. It let two probes out recently, and I've talked about both of them. They had planned to bring Hayabusa 2 probe down to Ryugu asteroid at the end of this month. The trouble is they can't find any place to land the thing. It's about the size of a refrigerator, and all they need is a flat space that's the size of a refrigerator, and they're good. But they've been circling it, trying to find one, and the darn thing doesn't have a flat space that long. So they're kind of sitting around thinking about it, and they figure hopefully they'll come up with something by around January. So poor Hayabusa 2 is waiting around hovering over this asteroid. It's a very small asteroid, by the way. It's only about 2,000 feet in diameter, and it's only, but about a billion pounds heavy. So it's a tiny little thing. Let me drop for any questions or comments.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I didn't know they were having that problem, but they're going to be very disappointed if they can't. They've got to get close to do it, because they need to get some material back into the spacecraft and then load it into the descent module, because eventually that's going to be sent back to Earth, sent back to, I believe they're going to land that one in the fields of Australia. And this is Hayabusa 2. Hayabusa 1 came back with something, but like grams, hardly anything. They were hoping to get a lot more from this one. I'll be following it. Back to you, Roy.
Very good, Paul. Yeah, the major premise was not to drop the little probes down on it. The major premise was to land on Ryugu, take a sample, and then eject it and get it back to Earth to examine. And of course, there's always guys out there who say, okay, this is the principal study to see the feasibility of mining asteroids. But, you know, I think if you add up the cost of, you know, even if you brought back diamonds, perfect diamonds, you'd end up in millions and millions of dollars of loss. So I hope they do find that little flat space, or they figure out a way to land on a craggy space. But I'm sure Paul will keep us advised, and I'll be watching the news as well.
I believe they also had one other lander that I think next year they were going to land that one. But I think they got three of them out so far, right?
Well, my understanding is that they've released two probes. Well, did they release two probes or three probes? I think they released three probes. They have a fourth sitting in the bay. I think they haven't decided whether or not to drop that one on the asteroid. They're cute little things. They don't have any wheels. They simply kind of pogo up and down. And they figured out that that's the best way of having them transport, because if they fitted them for anything like wheels, the force of the wheels would be afraid, would just have them slide right off the end of the asteroid into deep space.
Okay, yeah, that's probably the one I read about, where the gravitational pull is 180,000 of what we have here on Earth, so. Okay. I think the last two were from Germany, one that they let loose, and then the other one that they have on board, and I think it's the size of a small suitcase.
Yeah, the last one, if I remember correctly, was called Mascot. It was a very short-lived lithium batteries that should have lasted about 16 to 18 hours. I think it lasted something like 20 or 22. A very short-lived probe, but it was successful for what it was meant to do.
Yeah, hopefully they were able to bring something back. If not, we have one that's going to be heading in there soon. The OSIRIS-REx, that's designed to bring a lot more material back than Hayabusa 2. That's another story. Back to you, Roy.
Very good. Thank you, Paul. And, you know, it's going to be interesting to see what kind of material it comes back with, and if they find anything interesting. They usually find something interesting. So we'll hold our breath and see what happens. Vis-a-vis Richard's problem with his balance, about 3 weeks ago, we had a great discussion on balance, and it was less obvious, apparently, the ways that the balance could go wrong. And damage with balance, wire windings, or capacitors usually are obvious to visual investigation. But a balanced ferrite core, be it porous, be it a bar, be it something called a pig-nosed ferrite core, its damage can be very subtle things. I have always been fascinated by the almost magical nature of magnets and magnetism, and it is no doubt the seemingly magical nature of the closely related electromagnetic wave that has attracted us all to this hobby that we're now participating in. So I thought I might investigate how the balanced ferrite core does some of its own kind of magic. We all use the term magnetism for a collection of different phenomena, including a person's animal magnetism. But magnetism is not a single simple thing. For starters, there are many different types of magnetism in physics. What we usually mean when we say magnetism is more accurately termed ferromagnetism, objects that align atoms, half-filled electron shells spin with an external applied magnetic field. And when the external magnetic field is removed, the ferromagnetic dipoles are locked onto that orientation and continue to produce their own magnetic field. Let me drop for a sec. In fact, that is just one flavor that magnetism comes in. There is paramagnetism, where the material aligns its magnetic dipole moments with an external magnetic field and is attracted to the external magnetic field. But when that external magnetic field is removed, the material has no memory of that previous alignment of its own magnetic dipole moment. It tends to forget its previous magnetic alignment. There is diamagnetism, where the material reacts to an external magnetic field by aligning its own magnetic dipole moments in the opposite direction. And then there's something called anti-ferromagnetism and superparamagnetism. It could go on and on. Now, there's something called ferrimagnetism, not ferro, ferri. Ferrimagnetism is very similar to ferromagnetism, except that some atoms line up with the magnetic dipole moments of the applied external magnetic field, while others line up opposing the external magnetic field. These two opposing qualities are not equal, so in the end, a ferrimagnetic object is left with a net magnetic field aligned with the external magnetic field even after that external magnetic field is removed. Let me break for a second. Now, iron is ferromagnetic, but iron oxides exist in different oxygen states, sharing different number of electrons with different number of oxygen atoms. They're called ferric oxide, they're called ferrous oxide. It's this mixture of oxidation states that give iron oxides their ferrimagnetism. And even among ferromagnetic materials, there are different kinds. One type is called hard ferrite. By adding barium or strontium carbonate to the iron oxide, the material's own magnetic field, originally induced by an external magnetic field, is reinforced and more permanent. Described by terms like high coercivity or high remanence, these are the ceramic magnets that may be adorning your own refrigerator this very moment. The mineral magnetite, a hard ferrite, was probably the first magnet discovered by mankind. Let me drop for a second. Our special attention for tonight, though, is for the so-called soft ferrite, which have a low coercivity and a low remanence, barely holding on to any induced magnetic field soon after the external magnetic field is removed. They can therefore reverse their magnetic field without dissipating much energy or hysteresis loss. They're said to conduct magnetism more than store it. And it is this quality that makes them so useful to us as the core in inductors, transformers, and as common mode current suppressors. Soft ferrites are manufactured using a mixture of iron oxide, nickel, zinc, and manganese compounds, heated in a low oxygen environment at a particular temperature range and pressed into shape from sintered powder. Different mixes possess different characteristics, like permeability that was discussed earlier, magnetic saturation, frequency range, and temperature range. Now, mix number 31 is a favorite with hams, but the benefits of using other mixes is a great topic for argument on the HF band. Let me drop for a sec. The powder of an iron powder core is generally 10 microns and smaller. Powder is treated to oxidize nanometer-thick layers before it's pressed into a core with something like a 1 or 2% epoxy binder. The thin phosphate layer of the binder raises the bulk resistivity of the iron to about 10 trillion ohms, and eddy currents are essentially eliminated. if the core is heated beyond 170 degrees centigrade, the powder oxidizes more and the insulation layer is destroyed. The elemental magnetic iron volume falls off by the cube of the thickness of the oxidized iron. In addition, the permeability of the iron drops off by some exponential factor as the volume fraction of iron decreases. The resistance goes down to several ohms of the bulk powder. So you end up with a ferrite with a low permeability and very high eddy current. Such a ferrite has kicked the proverbial bucket. It shuffled off this mortal coil. It's run down the curtain and joined the bleeding choir invisible. This is an ex-ferrite. Let me drop for any comments or questions. This is AC2. Yeah.
Direction.
Yes, Wes.
I wasn't listening carefully when you said that it oxidizes and loses the resistance. The ferrite particles are purposely being oxidized. They're being rusted in order to have increased resistance. But also, I'm interested with you commenting on impedance and direction.
Well, I don't know if you could actually say that the ferrites have an inherent impedance. They have a permeability that affects inductive impedance and has no effect on capacitive impedance. It's more that the heat destroys the insulating binding material that causes the conductivity of the ferrite to drop down to a very well-conducted piece of material rather than the trillion ohm resistance that it has when the binder is attached.
Well, the thing is that even if you do not add binder, you're just dealing with oxidized or rusted particles of iron. You already have extremely high resistance in it. Now, the heat might destroy the compound that is holding it, but then I have a problem with you mentioning the heat is destroying rust, the oxide that is exposing particles to, and then eventually diminishing the resistance.
Well, it's a complicated structure. It usually contains other metals other than iron oxide in the mix, and apparently it's not fully oxidized. It's only partially oxidized. So if you oxidize more material, you lessen the permeability of the material as well as lower the resistance. There are other things that are conducting in that sludge, unfortunately. It's not rust. Rust is an important part of it, but the extra materials, I think, gives it its particular different quality.
Oh, yeah, I agree with you. Now, talking about the impedance, well, when you place when you measure the length of the particles, they're not necessarily nanometer length, they're micrometers length, mostly, especially those made in China. And this is a piece of metal that has a physical dimension. And then you place it in an environment that it resonates. So at first, you have a changing electromagnetic field around it, and then you put it in resonance. What's going to happen to it? And to exit?
I don't know if there is a resonance per se for soft ferrite material. I know that, as Dick mentioned earlier tonight, that the different qualities of these materials cause them to saturate and cause them to develop eddy currents despite the binder and such when the frequency reaches a high enough point. But I do not believe, and maybe Dick can educate me about this, that there is an inherent resonance quality to a ferrite core.
I haven't heard of a resonance other than your particular coil on that core might have a certain amount of inductance, and you put the right capacitor across it, you'll make a resonant circuit.
up.
You have a Faraday core that is made of particles of iron. These particles of iron have a physical length. By that, they are being looked at as pieces of conductor. And a piece of conductor has its own capacitance, that it has its own inductance. And then we can actually calculate the frequency at which